Hi class, it's your professor again, Dr. Fields, with part two of our lecture on sexual dysfunctions, paraphilic disorders, and gender dysphoria. So, we talked yesterday about the various sexual dysfunctions. Today we're actually going to talk about the two other categories within this lecture. Which are the paraphilic disorders and gender dysphoria. Okay, so if you're following along with your slides, I'm on slide number 16. Okay, so paraphilic disorders are essentially abnormal sexual practices that cause distress and/or life impairments. Simply having a quote fetish, for example, being turned on by feet, for example, is not a paraphilic disorder unless it causes distress. Okay? And also, I should add here, or it causes some kind of major life impairment, or causes another person distress, as you will see. A bunch of the different paraphilic disorders will actually cause another person distress. And so, for any of those reasons, it would be considered a disorder. So, just if you have an unusual fascination, with a certain inanimate object that turns you on sexually or something else, but it doesn't cause you distress, doesn't cause someone else distress, doesn't impair anyone's life functioning, then it would just be a fetish. Okay? All right. And that is our reoccurring DSM-5 catchphrase, right? They always have to have some kind of impairment for the person or for another person. Okay. Although it's interesting to bring up one disorder we've discussed already and another one we are going to refer to a little less directly when we go over the personality disorders. But pyromania, we've already discussed. That and serial killing are not technically listed as a paraphilia, but in a general sense, they are, because often a pyromaniac is very sexually turned on by the act of setting and watching his or her fires. Okay? And so it is common for them to get their sexual needs met or to get sexual gratification from their actual fire setting and then watching the fire. And I think I mentioned when we talked about the various impulse control disorders that a lot of times they will actually masturbate while watching their fires. Also, it is common for many serial killers to murder in order to fulfill, again, sexual needs and gratification. So, these two very abnormal kinds of acts that kind of turn these people on sexually, in a general sense, are paraphilias, but they're not listed as such. Okay? So that's what we're really talking about. Somebody with very unusual sexual needs. Okay? And so now let's go into the different kinds of paraphilias, and you're gonna see that a lot of these will actually cause distress or be harmful to other people. Okay, the first one, going on to slide number 17, is frotteristic disorder. The criteria here are for at least 6 months, there are recurrent and intense sexual arousal from touching or rubbing against a non-consenting person, as manifested by fantasies, urges or behaviors. The individual has acted on these sexual urges with a non-consenting person, or the sexual urges or fantasies cause clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. So what that essentially is saying is it's either causing them distress or it's causing their victim, for lack of a better way of saying it, distress. But it's causing people distress, and therefore it is a disorder, okay? So a frateristic act would be like, for example, let's say you're on the subway and you're forced to stand, and there's someone behind you, and they're rubbing up against you with their genitalia to, you know, get aroused. That would be a frateristic act. And I bring that example up because, unfortunately, it's not that uncommon. It's happened to a lot of people in those kind of cramped, tight quarters like the subway. And we have some specifiers here. In a controlled environment, that specifier is primarily applicable to individuals living in institutional or other settings where opportunities to touch or rub against a non-consenting person are restricted. Okay? Right, moving on to voyeuristic disorder. Over a period of at least 6 months, recurrent and intense sexual arousal from observing an unsuspected person who is naked in the process of disrobing or engaging in sexual activity as manifested by fantasies, urges, or behaviors. The individual has acted on these sexual urges with a non-consenting person, or the sexual urges or fantasies cause clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. That says a DSM-5 common catchphrase. Again, it's either causing distress or impairment in the person themselves, or the victim, or both. You know, the lay person's term for this would be like a peeping Tom, you know, somebody that is, you know, watching a neighbor in a window with a pair of binoculars, let's say, or hiding outside their house very close to the window in the bushes, watching them, you know, undress or have sex or something of that nature. Okay. Moving on. Slide 19 is exhibitionistic disorder. Okay. Over a period of at least 6 months, recurrent and intense sexual arousal from the exposure of one's genitals to an unsuspecting person as manifested by fantasies, urges, or behaviors. The individual has acted on these sexual urges with a non-consenting person, or the sexual urges or fantasies cause clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning, similar to the other three, other two. And then we have these specific specifiers: sexually aroused by exposing genitals to prepubertal children, sexually aroused by exposing genitals to physically mature individuals, and sexually aroused by exposing genitals to prepubertal children and to physically mature individuals. So that's kind of like a combination specifier. Why is that important? Well, if they have exhibitionistic disorder and they are exposing themselves to prepubertal children, it is very possible that this will be a precursor to another paraphilia known as pedophilic disorder, which we're going to discuss in just a little bit. Okay? So, exhibitionistic disorder is basically getting sexually aroused and turned on by exposing oneself to another individual. Okay, going on to slide 20. Fetishistic disorder. Over a period of at least 6 months, recurrent and intense sexual arousal from either the use of non-living objects or a highly specific focus on non-genital body parts as manifested by fantasies, urges, or behaviors. The fantasies, sexual urges, or behaviors cause clinically significant distress or impairment in that person's social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. And the fetish objects are not limited to articles of clothing using cross-dressing, as in transvestic disorder, or devices specifically designed for the purpose of tactile genital stimulation, such as vibrator. So, in other words, that's like a rule out saying that don't confuse this with transvestic disorder. And also, pointing out that what we're talking about is we're talking about an unusual sexual interest. Being interested in using a vibrator is not unusual. Being interested or being turned on by feet, by a cat, by some other kind of object, inanimate object, that is very unusual. But as I stated at the beginning of this lecture, it's not a disorder unless it causes a person or another person significant distress or impairment. So if they have some fascination sexually with feet or some other inanimate object, or I'm sorry, or an inanimate object, that's not a problem. It's only a problem if it causes them problems or another person. Okay? Just thinking of an example here. Let's say they had a roommate in college, and while the roommate is sleeping, they're staring at their feet and masturbating, and they might be okay with it, but then when the roommate catches them, they're not okay with it. That would be evidence of some kind of disorder, okay? And different from exhibitionistic disorder because the person is asleep. People with exhibitionistic disorder get a lot of sexual excitement from the person's expression when they see their genitals being exposed. So that would be the difference with those two situations there. Okay? And then we have specifiers. Is the fetish a body part, a non-sexual body part, or an inanimate or non-living object, or something else? Okay, moving on. Transvestic disorder. This is where the term transvestite comes from. Over a period of at least 6 months, recurrent and intense sexual arousal from cross-dressing as manifested by fantasies, urges, or behaviors. Cross-dressing essentially is just wearing the clothes of an opposite gender. The fantasies, sexual urges, or behaviors cause clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. So, just because you might identify yourself as being a transvestite, somebody who gets sexually turned on and aroused by wearing the opposite gender's clothes, does not mean you have a disorder. It becomes transvestic disorder when, again, that old catchphrase applies. Okay? And then we have some specifiers here. With fetishism, if sexually aroused by fabrics, materials, or garments, certain types of fabrics, materials, or garments, with Autogynephilia, if sexually aroused by thoughts or images of self as a female. Now, this needs to be differentiated from one feeling that they should be the other opposite sex, that they were born into the wrong body, or they were born into the wrong gender's body. And we're going to talk about that when we get to gender dysphoria. So, people with transvestic disorder do not feel that they should be a different gender. They just get very turned on by wearing the opposite gender's clothing. And may get turned on by imagining themselves as the other gender in the situation, but imagining oneself as being the other gender while dressed accordingly to that gender, for sexual gratification is very different from, thinking that, you are naturally the wrong gender. Does that make sense? Okay, moving on. Sexual, sadistic, and masochistic disorders. I was crafty enough to actually fit both of these onto one slide. Very impressed with myself. The first one is sexual sadistic disorder. Over a period of at least 6 months, recurrent and intense sexual arousal from the physical or psychological suffering of another person as manifested by fantasies, urges, or behaviors. The individual has acted on these sexual urges with a non-consenting person, or the sexual urges or fantasies cause clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. So again, like many of these paraphilias, it either causes a problem for the person themselves or another person. Okay? Sexual masochistic disorder is the opposite. Over a period of at least 6 months, recurrent and intense sexual arousal from the act of being humiliated, beaten, bound, or otherwise made to suffer, basically being dominated, right, by another person, as manifested by fantasies, urges, or behaviors. The fantasies, sexual urges, or behaviors cause clinically significant distress or impairment. Now, why for sexual masochistic disorder do they not also add that, this could be a problem for another person? Because by definition, somebody who has masochistic disorder is not trying to harm another person, they want to be harmed. So there won't ever be a victim in this kind of situation, so to speak. Okay? Now, this is not the same as somebody who practices S&M, right? Which is sadism, masochism. You can practice S&M and take on the role of a sadist. And that is totally fine as long as you're okay with it and the person or partner is consenting and thus okay with it. So this becomes a disorder only when it causes you problems or another person's problem. But there are many people that practice an S&M lifestyle that would not qualify as having a disorder. Would we say their behavior or sexual interests are very atypical? I mean, contrary to what Hollywood would like us to believe, it's very rare that people are turned on by S&M. Many people, in terms of their sexual preferences, sometimes might like to be spanked during sexual intercourse or something of that nature. That doesn't rise to the same level as what we're talking about with S&M, okay? And S&M does not rise to the same level as being a disorder in terms of what we're talking about here, because what we're talking about here is it causing the person a great amount of distress or someone else. So, sexual sadists. Could they very well become rapists? Absolutely. right? And that's obviously a big problem. So, that's what we're talking about with these disorders, which is very different from the just practice of S&M, which is an atypical sexual interest, okay? And there's also a specifier here that is very specific to sexual masochistic disorder, which is, you'll see that specifier there, with asphyxiophilia. Sorry, that is not an easy one to pronounce. Asphyxiophilia. If the individual engages in the practice of achieving sexual arousal related to restriction of breathing, then they would meet this specifier. So, in other words, that they need to be choked, or they need to choke themselves in order to really have an orgasm or climax. Okay? All right. Let's see if I can say that one more time. Asphyxiophilia. Not an easy one. All right. Moving on to the last one, and one of the most dangerous ones for society, pedophilic disorder, right? So this is basically, we're talking about a pedophile, okay? Unlike the other disorders, which can have a disordered version and a non-disordered version, pedophilia, or being a pedophile, is always going to be a disorder, because it's always going to involve, well, actually, let me back up there for a second. Let me think this one through. Is pedophilic disorder always, I'm sorry, is pedophilia, or being a pedophile, always a disorder in the sense that it has a negative impact on the person or child? In the large majority of cases, absolutely. Okay? Certainly, if they act out on this impulse and they abuse a child, it is absolutely a disorder, hands down. For many of them that don't act on this impulse, they still feel very ashamed about having these impulses, and so that then causes them a lot of distress, and in that regard is also a disorder. But I'm thinking of a very rare exception in which somebody has fantasies of being with a young child but never acts on them and is not distressed by them. That case, interestingly enough, would not be considered a disorder, even though many of us would be kind of disgusted by it, right? Or outraged that there are people that exist there. That would not be a disorder, because there's no victim and the person is not distressed. However, that is so rare that that would be the situation. So in almost all the cases, almost all the cases, any kind of instance of this kind of attraction to children would be a disorder. Because even if they're downloading child pornography from the internet, there is still a victim. That child who was forced into that pornographic situation, or forced to make a sex tape, or to have these kind of inappropriate pictures taken of them, that child is still a victim in those situations. So that's why I say in almost all these cases it would be considered a disorder. It would have to be somebody that's never downloaded or looked at child pornography, never acted on their impulses, and is fine with it. That's very rare. So interesting to think about some of the nuances of these different disorders. Okay, let's go over the specific criteria here. Again, over a period of at least 6 months. Some of you may be thinking, like, why always 6 months? That comes from research. You know, that's how they come up with these different kinds of criteria. You know, they don't just kind of come up with it willy-nilly and say, yeah, what do you think? 6 months sounds good. These come from research that shows that, you know, people that tend to have a certain kind of disorder, it's persisted for at least 6 months. So that's how they come up with that. So over a period of at least 6 months, recurrent, intense, sexually arousing fantasies, urges, or behaviors involving sexual activity with a prepubescent child or children, generally age 13 years or younger. Okay? So if somebody is very attracted to a 15 or 16-year-old child, that doesn't make them a pedophile. Of course, it could still get them into lots of legal trouble if they engage in some kind of relationship with that child, but it wouldn't necessarily be considered pedophilic disorder. They tend to be attracted by young children, okay, 13 years or younger. Criterion B, the individual has acted on these sexual urges or the sexual urges or fantasies cause marked distress or interpersonal difficulty. And acting on these sexual urges, again, doesn't just mean sexually molesting or abusing a child. It could also be downloading child pornography, because that also, there is a victim involved. And do you know where I learned that from? Law and Order, one of my favorite shows, SVU. The episode that I'm thinking of had to do with them making the point that if you're downloading child pornography, then you're basically promoting it and supporting the perpetrators, and thereby re-victimizing the victim. Okay. Moving on. Oh, and there's also a specifier here to whether or not the individual is attracted more to males, females, and if it's limited to incest. And also if it's exclusive in terms of the person only being attracted to children, and non-exclusive, whereby the individual is attracted to children, but also mature adults. The exclusive type tends to be the more common type. Okay, let's look at some prevalence rates here. For voyeuristic disorder, the lifetime prevalence rate is estimated to be no more than 12% for men and no more than 4% for women. For exhibitionistic disorder, it's estimated to be no more than 4% for men. For frotteristic disorder, they don't have any estimates for the actual disorder, but they have estimates for frotteristic acts, okay? They are estimated to be 30% for men. That is a lot. So what that's basically saying is it could be as high as almost one-third of all men have engaged in at least one time in their life a frotteristic act. So, of course, for the actual disorder, which would be recurrent acts and all the other criteria that go along with that, that estimate would be far fewer. But that's a shocking number, isn't it, if that's true? Sexual sadism disorder, the estimates vary very wildly from 2 to 30%. Okay, so depending on what research study you're looking at and depending on, you know, the different criteria they're applying. For pedophilic disorder, it's estimated to be no more than 5% for men. And for transvestic disorder, it's estimated, actually they don't have an estimate for the actual disorder, but they do have an estimate for men being aroused ever in their lives by dressing in women's clothes. So, in other words, for any man who has ever been aroused by dressing in women's clothes, you're talking about less than 3%, which means for the actual disorder where they're doing it on a recurrent basis is even a much lower estimate. So a very, very rare kind of disorder. You'll see in all of these that they're all estimates. You know, we don't have such good research studies to really, you know, make us feel confident with these kinds of estimates, or I'm sorry, with these kinds of statistics or prevalence rates. And one of the reasons probably is because it's probably very hard to find people that will admit to these. And so therefore, you know, the sample sizes are probably very small, and very limited, okay? One thing that should stand out right away for all of you is that paraphilic disorders are much more common in men than women. For example, a female pedophile is very rare. Okay? And, you know, I'm not talking about the, you know, what you see in the news sometimes where there's a female teacher who has a sexual relationship with a 16-year-old. That wouldn't necessarily meet criteria for a pedophilic disorder. We're talking about generally the child is much younger than that. And it's recurrent. It's not a one-time thing. Okay? All right. Moving on. Causes. Biological. Unknown. We don't have a lot of research on these disorders because, as I stated, many people do not feel comfortable admitting to having this kind of disorder. So because there's such a lack of research, and particularly in terms of biological factors, we really don't know if there are any kind of biological factors that underlie these disorders. My hunch would be that, like all the other disorders we've discussed, there, you know, I would hypothesize that there were some underlying biological contributors for sure. But what we do know is that there definitely seem to be some psychological factors. So let's look at that. Childhood experiences that lead to unhealthy sexual development are often implicated in these disorders. So it seems that many of these disorders develop in childhood. And due to unhealthy kinds of childhood experiences, you know, to be more general. So what does this look like? Well, this can include a lack of an appropriate social experience, development, and skills. And thus, later difficulty relating to sexually mature, consenting adults. You can almost look at many of these disorders as being a byproduct of stunted social development, that, you know, a lot of these individuals have social skill deficits, are not mature socially, have a difficult time relating to people their own age. This can also include sexual abuse as a child, which can also be another factor that can really lead to disturbed or abnormal sexual interests or practices, et cetera, especially if you're talking about pedophilic disorder or sexual sadism. We know that a lot of people that have been sexually abused tend to go on and kind of continue that cycle and become sexual abusers themselves. In addition, these individuals could also have developed an abnormal sexual interest unintentionally. For example, as a child with their first experiences of masturbating, give an example, while masturbating, let's say there were a pair of woman's shoes lying on the floor and they were viewing them as they masturbated, and now there's a or an association between the shoes and sexual gratification. So basically, what process are we talking about here? Classical conditioning, right? It's that kind of learning process, that we talk about with behavioral therapy, okay? Or they could be masturbating and then all of a sudden glance out their window and see their neighbor in the house next door, very scantily dressed or naked, and again associate voyeurism or watching another person with masturbation. Okay? And I'm also, now that I'm thinking about this, when you're talking about exhibitionistic disorder, what if they were masturbating and all of a sudden somebody walked in on them and then they climaxed at that point? They may then have built an association that, sexual gratification is associated with somebody seeing your genitals exposed or seeing you masturbate. But I would say, on a more general level, many, many, many people with paraphilias have had some kind of unhealthy childhood development, particularly when we're talking about in particular their social development, or has had some horrible thing happen to them in their childhood, like sexual abuse. Okay. After the first time a person, so now we're going to start talking about how this behavior pattern of sexual arousal really becomes reinforced and ingrained. After the first time experiencing pleasure with a paraphilia, whether in real life or fantasy, them envisioning it, this behavior continues and grows stronger as the person learns that it is associated with pleasure. That's the whole learning process of positive reinforcement. Okay, so we have classical conditioning to build the association, and then continuing doing it and each time being positively reinforced by feeling good sexually and being able to climax from it. Paradoxically, now, as they continue to do this, the more these individuals try to suppress these thoughts related to the paraphilia, as many of them feel ashamed about it, the stronger the urges become. And then their giving into them only strengthens this sexual compulsion. This is very similar to that obsessive compulsive feedback loop, right? That people with OCD, the more they obsess about something, right? They then do this compulsive behavior to kind of release the tension of these unwanted thoughts, but that only releases tension in the moment, and it actually reinforces this whole feedback loop, this loop as we call it, and so therefore makes it even stronger and makes these obsessions even stronger. So when these people engage in this paraphilia every time, that only makes the urges stronger. And that's also very similar to addictive disorders, right? Every time somebody engages in an addictive behavior, once they're addicted, that only serves to reinforce their addiction, right? Also, like addictions, paraphilias can also serve psychological functions such as emotional regulation, coping strategy, self-medication, etc. Okay? Okay, so how do we treat paraphilias? Well, if we're talking about a paraphilia that has a victim or victims involved, right? It causes distress in another person. In terms of what kinds of medical treatments are available, there are a class of drugs or different drugs in the class that we call chemical castration medication. And basically, what these drugs do is almost completely eliminate any kind of sexual arousal from anything. Okay? But the person needs to be motivated to continually take these drugs. In other words, just like when we were talking about alcohol addiction, and the drug ant abuse, right? So in other words, going back to that lecture, if somebody doesn't want to drink, they can take ant abuse, and once they take it, they know if they drink, they'll get very, very sick. But that only works if the person takes the ant abuse. So you might ask yourself, well, why would they want to, do that to themselves? How come they would be so motivated? Well, many of them are very ashamed of their behavior and, do not like to cause other people distress, but they feel they need to get the sexual gratification. So those people would be motivated because they just, they have a good conscience and they don't want to harm people. And then that would be like an intrinsic motivation, right? It's their personal reasons for, not wanting to act on this behavior. And then we have extrinsic motivation, which is basically they're motivated by other people or other circumstances outside of themselves to take the medication. And the best example I can come up with is a pedophile who gets arrested for acting out on their impulse and then is ordered by the court to take this kind of medication or else go to jail. So, in other words, they'll meet with a probation officer, they'll have to give urine samples, and if they're found to not be compliant with this medication, then it's an immediate, do not pass, go directly to jail kind of situation. And the different kinds of medications we're talking about here, cyproterone acetate, medroxyprogesterone, and triptorelin. I think I pronounced those right. All right. Also, as far as medical treatment, just like as we talked about for eating disorders and the somatoform disorders or somatic-related disorders, even though medication has not been found to be so helpful in terms of directly intervening with these kinds of symptoms, they could be helpful indirectly in terms of if the person is also struggling with an anxiety or depressive disorder. And so the medication can help with their other disorder that, exacerbates their paraphilic disorder. So, in other words, an example that comes to mind for me is, let's say you have a person with voyeurism who suffers from severe social anxiety. So voyeurism is that whole peeping Tom syndrome where the person is watching another person, but the other person doesn't know, and they're masturbating to them, right? They're engaging in a sexual activity. And the reason for this particular person's voyeurism may be because they have such severe social anxiety that they're so fearful of approaching another person and trying to have a mature, consenting sexual relationship with them for fear of rejection that they kind of, do it without the other person's knowledge, right? So if you treated their social anxiety, and they now had a lot less anxiety in terms of approaching people, that could then indirectly help them get over their voyeuristic tendencies. Does that make sense? Right? So, in other words, certain disorders could arise from other disorders. And if we treat, that other condition, it might lead to improvements in their paraphilic disorder. Okay. Psychological interventions. Cognitive behavioral therapy, we'll talk about first. So, again, as traditional cognitive behavioral therapy, what we might want to do is combat any unhealthy thoughts that they might have. Okay. Especially like going back to that example I just told you about the person who could have social anxiety disorder, and that's kind of the impetus for why they engage in voyeurism. We might treat their unhealthy thoughts of, people are always going to reject me, nobody's going to want to have a normal sexual relationship with me. And this really could be for a variety of the different kinds of paraphilias, right? Even fetishistic disorder or what have you, right? For many of these people, they're avoiding a mature sexual relationship, possibly for fears of being rejected. So we can combat those thoughts that are related to that fear of rejection. We could also teach them consequential thinking skills in terms of getting them to regularly acknowledge and keep in the forefront of their minds at all times, these bad consequences that could happen to them, in terms of them definitely, eliciting rejection from people because of this kind of behavior. And legal trouble, right? Many of these disorders, if acted upon, are illegal and will cause legal difficulties, okay? We can also teach them stimulus control techniques. Stimulus control has to do with avoiding triggers. So, avoiding stimuli that kind of cue or trigger the behavior. So, in other words, if you want to reduce your urges, your sexual urges, whatever gives rise to them, whether it be an inanimate object, or some kind of situation, we're going to try to avoid that, or teach them to avoid those situations that tend to cue that behavior, okay? If we find that this behavior serves some kind of coping function, right? Like an addiction, we're going to try to teach them healthier coping skills and techniques. And for many of these people who have social skill deficits, we're going to teach them effective social skills so that this can lead to the potential for them to develop more healthy, appropriate relationships with adults, okay? Now, there are two specific cognitive behavioral techniques for paraphilic disorders that have been come up that have been created. One is called covert sensitization. This is very interesting. So, what you do is you have the person fantasize about the source of sexual arousal, of their sexual arousal, and then they are directed to imagine very bad consequences occurring as a result. So, in other words, they may masturbate to the image of a young child, and after a little bit of time, we then direct them to immediately switch to imagining horrible consequences happening to them, such as them getting caught by somebody and eventually getting arrested and going to jail, or some other negative consequence happening because of their action. Okay? And this is more of like a behavioral technique, under the cognitive behavioral umbrella, that's really trying to utilize the principle of extinction, getting rid of that association, right? If we constantly pair it with a negative experience, eventually it will not give them any pleasure, is the theory. Okay? Now, the other technique, which is also equally interesting, is called orgasmic conditioning. This is very interesting. So, the person, and again, based off primarily behavioral therapy, orgasmic conditioning is when a person fantasizes about the source of their sexual arousal while masturbating, and then right before ejaculation, they are directed to envision an appropriate sexual experience. This appropriate image is gradually envisioned earlier on during masturbation until the person only has this image. So, using that same example, if the person started to masturbate to a young child, right before they ejaculate, they then are to automatically switch to imagining being with a consenting mature adult. And you then gradually have them envision that earlier on and earlier on in their kind of sexual fantasy sequence until you get to the point where they can start by envisioning being with a mature consenting adult from start to finish. Okay? Interesting specific techniques for paraphilias. One caveat here is this should be obvious. The person has to be motivated. If they are not motivated, it's not going to work. Because they can tell you that, yeah, I'm doing it. I'm envisioning, what you want me to envision, and meanwhile, they're not doing it, right? So obviously, this has to be only in cases where the person is motivated. Psychodynamic reasons for these paraphilias, or I'm sorry, psychodynamic therapy techniques for these paraphilias would be, on a general level, similar to all psychodynamic therapy, where, we hypothesize there is some unconscious, repressed motivation or drive that's really behind these inappropriate sexual behaviors. All right? And then from a family or systems perspective, what you would try to do is, if we're dealing with a child or an adolescent who is still living at home, we would try to help the family function in a healthier manner to improve the child's social development. And if they're an adult in a relationship, we could do couples therapy to foster a healthier romantic relationship between the patient and the partner. And so the thinking behind this is if they're getting pleasure out of their appropriate, mature romantic relationship, they won't look for pleasure elsewhere. Okay? And for young children, or for children rather, and adolescents, we're trying to correct their faulty social development before they become an adult. Early intervention, right? Okay, moving on to gender dysphoria. We are now up to slide 28. Gender dysphoria is the newest term. In the third edition of the DSM, it was called transsexualism. Okay, that's where you get the term transsexual. Then in DSM-4, they changed the term to gender identity disorder. And the more recent term now in the DSM's current revision, which is the fifth edition, it's now called gender dysphoria. As I stated in the introduction to this two-part lecture series on sexual disorders, I have a problem with them referring to this as a disorder. Now, you might look at this and say, well, just like a lot of the paraphilias, it's a, very abnormal, atypical kind of situation, right? That many times will cause the person a great deal of distress. So, just like a lot of the, when we're talking about the paraphilias or even the sexual dysfunctions, it meets the criteria for causing distress. Okay? However, I and many others really feel that this condition is something one is born with and has virtually no relationship to psychological factors. I don't think anybody chooses to have this condition, right? Just in the same way that I don't think people who are gay choose to be gay. And I'm not saying that, you wouldn't want to choose to be gay because there's something, bad about it or wrong about it. I'm saying many people would not want to be gay or would not want to have this kind of condition that we're going to discuss simply because, it's not very accepted by many people, and there are a lot of obstacles that one has to go through, when dealing with these kinds of situations. And so, what am I saying in a nutshell? It's not easy being gay, and it in our society, and it's definitely not easy having this condition where you feel that you are the wrong gender, okay? So let's take a look at the. Oh, what was my main point here? So going back to what I was saying about, well, it's like a lot of the disorders because it creates distress. Well, being gay creates a lot of distress, particularly if your family is not accepting of it or the region of where you're living tends to frown upon it. It can be difficult, right? And that experience could then cause you a lot of distress. Listen, in a perfect world, if everybody was very accepting as they should be, then people who were gay would not be distressed at all, right? And people who, think that they're the wrong gender would not have any kind of distress related to acceptance. They would have distress, maybe in terms of other things, in terms of having to change their body, but they wouldn't have distress over acceptance, okay? So that's why I don't consider these disorders. And, the comparison that I make is, listen, there are many situations in life where it's completely normal to be distressed. If you lose a loved one, right, because they die, that's very distressing, okay? But we don't call that a disorder. We call that bereavement. In other words, there is a, socially acceptable term that we use for it that does not have a connotation that it's a disorder or abnormal in terms of a negative connotation, right? And I think that these, this condition, that's what I'm going to call it, a condition, not a disorder. I'm going to call it a condition of gender dysphoria, is more in line with that. Is it rare? It's extremely rare. You're going to see just how rare. But being rare is not enough to say it's a disorder. You can say it's not within the norm, absolutely. But being a genius is not within the norm. And guess what? Being a genius also has its challenges, right? A lot of people may not understand you, or you might have social difficulties because you're on a very different level than other people. And that in and by itself can cause distress for the person. So, just because something causes you distress and is atypical, right, does not mean it's a disorder. Okay, so I'll get off my soapbox now. Let's take a look at the more specific criteria of gender dysphoria. We have two sets, one for children and one for adolescents. On slide 29, that's where we are now, a marked incongruence between one's experience or expressed gender and assigned gender of at least 6 months' duration, as manifested by at least six of the following: a strong desire to be of the other gender, or an insistence that one is the other gender, or some alternative gender different from one's assigned gender. In boys, assigned gender, a strong preference for cross-dressing or simulating female attire, or in girls, assigned gender, a strong preference for wearing only typical masculine clothing and a strong resistance to the wearing of typical feminine clothing. So this cross-dressing is very different from transvestism. This is not because they get sexual gratification out of wearing the opposite gender's clothes. It's because they feel like they are the actual that actual gender, that different gender. Three, a strong preference for cross-gender roles and make-believe play or fantasy play. A strong preference for the toys, games, or activities stereotypically used or engaged in by the other gender. A strong preference for playmates of the other gender, right? Just to skip through some of these, essentially what we're talking about is it's very reflected in their behavior, in their attitudes, in their feelings, in their preferences, that, this desire to be or another gender, or to relate more to the opposite gender that they are. Okay? And here is the criteria for gender dysphoria in adolescents and adults. The main one, again, being the first criterion within A, that is a marked incongruence between one's experienced, expressed gender and primary and/or secondary sex characteristics, or in young adolescents, the anticipated secondary sex characteristics. Essentially what that's saying is they don't feel like they are the correct gender. They feel like they were born into the wrong body. Okay? A man, with a man's body, feeling that they are essentially a female. You can look at it as a man thinking or believing he has a female mind, right? Or a female thinking or believing that she has a man's mind. And so they're kind of like feeling trapped in the wrong body. And if you could imagine what that must feel like, that's going to cause you a lot of impairment. And that's where they get the term dysphoria from. Dysphoria has to do with a negative mood. Well, yeah, right? If you felt that you were born into the wrong body, the wrong gender's body, you would definitely feel very distressed and upset about that. Okay? So, this is a very rare disorder. Okay? Going on to slide 31, you'll see that prevalence rate there. It's estimated to be somewhere between 0.005 to 0.014%. Okay? So, if you're looking at that, you're talking about like 1/100th of a percent, okay, of people or less. So that is quite rare. As I stated before, one of the other main reasons I don't believe this should be included as a disorder, especially a psychological disorder, is because there is a lack of strong evidence for any kind of psychological factors, right? So this really seems to be more of a biological kind of disorder. No, I'm sorry, not disorder, condition. This tends to be more of a biological condition. You were just kind of born that way. In the same way we look at people who are gay, we consider that they just were born that way, or we assume that. At least us experts in mental health, believe that. Okay? So just because we haven't found a lot of strong evidence for different kind of biological reasons or factors doesn't mean that they don't exist, and we really do, many of us experts believe that they do exist. It's just a matter of time before they find them. But one thing we can say at this point in time is we haven't found any strong psychological factors, but we have found some biological factors already. Some evidence exists that genes increase levels of sex hormones in utero during pregnancy, right? And brain structure differences are related to this disorder. So there is some biological evidence. And I really believe over time they're going to find a lot more, okay? One of the most famous people that has gender dysphoria, or rather this gender identity condition, is Caitlyn Jenner, right? Okay. As far as treatments, again, because we're really looking at this as being more of a biological condition, the psychological interventions that we would use have a lot more to do with helping them feel good about themselves, making sure they have a good self-concept in spite of possibly experiencing rejection from others or bullying if they're a young child. So helping them with that and navigate through those difficulties. Also helping them assess the degree or the extent of the incongruence between the patient's natal gender, which basically means the gender they were born with, and the gender they identify with. In other words, is there a little incongruence there, or is there a lot of incongruence there? And the reason why we would want to assess that is to see just the extent that they're going to want to go in terms of making a transition, if that's what they feel is necessary. If there's a more mild level of incongruence and they're not feeling like, 90 to 100% certain that they're the wrong gender, then, maybe there's a different route they take, in terms of, expressing themselves more in terms of their behavior and what they wear and how they identify, et cetera, et cetera. But if there's more of an incongruence where they feel like, no, I totally feel like I'm trapped in the wrong gender's body, then they're going to need to take more drastic measures in order to really, feel right, for lack of a better way of saying it, okay? And so a lot of the therapy will revolve around evaluating potential risks of expressing their non-conforming gender or the gender that they identify with. What is that going to entail? What kind of obstacles are you going to encounter? And then the risks of eventually possibly proceeding with biological treatments that could involve hormone therapy and, at the very extreme, sexual reassignment surgery, or the most drastic, rather, being sexual reassignment surgery. So really weighing the pros and cons of that. Because, once you start going into those kind of treatments, they tend to be not so reversible. So you better make sure that that's, what you really want to do, okay? And that's what psychotherapy can help with. All right. So that concludes our lecture on sexual dysfunctions, paraphilic disorders, and gender dysphoria. Stay tuned for the next lecture. Check 1, 2, 1, 2, check, check, check.